job down at the local mill. Work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. Repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me wife, kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working.
Welcome to the January 29th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management or board of directors. Now here's Tom with acknowledgement of some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you, the listeners of WEFT, and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, I'm your host, Bob Pilesny, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. And Tom's poem for this week, from his book Which Way Is Oz, is entitled College Kids from Garcia's Loft. Also with us here today is Jason Kozlowski, labor news, history, commentary. I think that's good for this week, right?
All-around nonsense.
Yeah, there you go. And also with us this week is one of the founders of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorrell. Always a pleasure to have Bill in with us. I'm sure he'll be here with some commentary and other news stories. So now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers Interest News.
According to the Illinois Department of Employment Security, unemployment rates in both Champaign and Vermilion counties dropped slightly during the month of December. Champaign County's rate dropped to 7.5%, down from the 8.3% for the month of November. The last time the rate was that low was in May of 2009, when the unemployment rate stood at 7.2%. Vermilion County's rate dropped to 10.2% for the month of December, down from November's rate of 11%. The rates for the cities of Champaign and Urbana both went down in December, with Champaign's dropping from 8% to 7.1%, while Urbana went from 9% to 7.8%. Danville's rate also fell to 10.7% for the month of December, down from the 11.8% recorded in November. Every other area county saw their unemployment rates drop by nearly a full percentage point. Among the state's 12 metropolitan areas, Champaign-Urbana had the third lowest rate behind the Bloomington-Normal and Springfield. Danville had the state's fourth highest rate behind Rockford, Kankakee-Bradley, and Decatur. Amongst the 102 counties in the state of Illinois, Brown County had the lowest unemployment rate at 4.5% in December, while Winnebago County had the highest rate at 13.8%. Jason?
The UAW will attempt to shame Asian and German-owned automakers into remaining neutral as the union tries to organize their plants in the U.S. In December, UAW members demonstrated near Detroit in support of Korean workers striking Hyundai. The United Auto Workers announced a $60 million plan this month to organize the foreign-owned auto plants in the Midwest and South. UAW President Bob King said if this were poker, the campaign would be, and quote, all in hand. If we lose, we'll die quicker. If we win, we rebuild the UAW, end quote. The union's numbers have fallen from 1.5 million in 1979 to 350,000 today. Only 53,000 work at GM, for example, compared to 475,000 then, a result of outsourcing speed up through lean production and lost market share. Some of those lost sales have been taken over by the so-called transplants, 14 Asian and German-owned assembly plants and dozens of parts factories built since the 1980s, employing around 50,000 hourly workers by UAW estimates. Those plants produced 43.6% of all vehicles made in the U.S. last year, according to the automotive research firm Baum & Associates. In the past, Toyota, Mercedes, and the rest pegged their wages very near Big Three levels to keep the union out. But today, King says, those companies, quote, don't fear us or respect us, end quote. He cites Nissan's wage scheme at its new Mississippi plant, where new hires will never reach the level of current workers. Of course, that's also true in UAW contracts with the Big Three, where since 2007, new hires have started at half wages, around $14 an hour. That's the rub for the union, which must convince non-union workers that they need to join a union that's going backward on wages, benefits, and shop floor control. Bob?
Okay, this story is from one of our favorite labor reporters, Stephen Greenhouse, writing for the New York Times. The number of American workers in unions declined sharply last year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported on Friday, with the percentage slipping to 11.9%, the lowest rate in more than 70 years. The report found that the number of workers in unions fell by 612,000 last year to 14.7 million, an even larger decrease than the overall 417,000 decline in the total number of Americans working. The number of private sector workers in unions fell by 339,000 to 7.1 million, while the number of public sector union members fell by 273,000 to 7.6 million. The percentage of private sector workers in unions fell to 6.9%, down from 7.2%, the lowest rate of private sector workers in more than a century, labor historians said. In 2009, for the first time in American history, government employees accounted for more than half the nation's union membership, but the percentage of government workers in unions fell to 36.2%, down from 37.4% the previous year. The Bureau of Labor Statistics said the overall unionization rate last year was down from 12.3% in 2009 and 20.1% in 1983. And the peak unionization rate was 35% during the mid-50s, after a surge in unionization during the Great Depression and after World War II. Last year's drop in union membership stemmed partly from large-scale layoffs in several sectors, with many union members, most notably construction, manufacturing, teaching, and local government. Another factor that has pushed down unionization, he said, is that companies have grown more ideologically opposed to unions and more aggressive about resisting organizing drives. In 2009, union membership fell by 771,000, largely because employment declined overall, but that decline followed a surprising spurt in union membership. Union ranks grew by a total of 739,000 the previous 2 years because of increased employment and some large successful unionization drives. According to the Bureau, New York had the highest unionization rate of any state at 24.2%, followed by Alaska at 22.9% and Hawaii at 21.8%. North Carolina had the lowest rate at 3.2%, with Arkansas and Georgia tied for the second lowest at 4%. Bill?
Yeah, you're talking about how companies were being much more aggressive than in the past, and that's because it's acceptable.
Yes.
You know, that's just it. It's become acceptable in the United States and our society and our culture for companies to be aggressively anti-labor. And that if you just go back, you know, to the post-depression era and post-depression culture of the United States, up pretty much through the 1970s, the working class American was highly lauded, and there was quite often themes run through much cultural output, TV shows, movies, and such, you know, relating to unions and labor, and it didn't necessarily have to be in a good way, but it's just the idea that those things had to be addressed in a TV show or something because they were commonplaces at that time in the society, in the culture. And that's just it. I mean, there are many groups that, you know, companies would never think of going after in any sense at all, even if it was to their advantage, just because the social uproar would be so huge. And, you know,
Well, that kind of leads into my second story,
because I was kind of leading into nowhere with myself, oblivion.
Another one of our favorite reporters, Mike Elk, has a story here about why do most media ignore worker struggles. So, but we'll let Tom go on with his story.
Economic development groups in northwestern Indiana have been taking steps recently to persuade Illinois businesses to move to northwest Indiana. One of their steps is an advertising campaign highlighting the area's transportation infrastructure and their proximity to Chicago and its suburban communities for a labor force. The Marketing and Communications Director of the Economic Development Group, known as the Northwest Indiana Forum, reports that a number of area groups are presently cooperating in the campaign, which actually began before Illinois chose to boost its income taxes. 2 weeks ago, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation also launched a new advertising campaign to place billboards in Illinois border communities and to buy advertising online and in newspapers in Chicago, Peoria, and Springfield. According to Mitch Rube, Indiana's Secretary of Commerce and CEO of the IEDC, we'll also be knocking on doors. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has stated that the income tax increase is something the state needs to pay its bills and has stressed that it is intended to expire in 4 years. Quinn signed the legislation raising both the personal and corporate income taxes to help address billions of dollars in government shortfalls. However, if Indiana starts taking Illinois' businesses, these shortfalls are only going to increase frighteningly. Jason?
Interestingly enough, I heard a radio advertisement from New Jersey businesses this week on the radio looking to poach Illinois business as well.
Yeah, Governor Chris Christie?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I heard that. That was interesting.
Yeah. 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 The vultures are swooping in. I neglected to mention that the previous story was courtesy of one of our other favorite sources, people, and publications. And that was from Jane Slaughter of Labor Notes. This is from the News Gazette this morning. That a University of Illinois union voted overwhelmingly Friday to authorize a strike if its leaders deem that step necessary. Ricky Baldwin, field organizer for Service Employees International Union Local 73, said 98% of its food service workers and 94% of its building service workers voted to authorize a strike after negotiating for over 6 months. Baldwin said it is likely the leadership would decide on a strike at a later date. The union has to give 10 days notice prior. The union agreed to meet with the university again on February 4th. Baldwin did acknowledge that Friday's negotiations had seen some quote-unquote marginal improvement with the university that was pleasing to the union. There are about 800 Urbana campus building and food service workers in the union. Baldwin said food service workers earn an average of about $15,000 a year, saying, quote, they get laid off every summer, a week at Thanksgiving, a month at Christmas, another week in the spring, and they are ineligible for unemployment because they can be called back at any time for a couple hours here or there. End quote. Building service workers average about $30,000 annually, he said. But, quote, the injury rate is higher in climbing because they are being asked to cover two or three jobs now, and workers' comp pays a lot less than the full wage, end quote. The union rejected a proposal from the University of Illinois in November that union members characterize as a wage freeze. The union said that some of the rule changes it has asked for would not cost the University of Illinois any money anyway. Bob?
Okay, this story is from another friend of ours, or I should say one of our favorite labor reporters also, Mike Elk. We reported on a couple of his stories, specifically the Honeywell situation down there in Metropolis, Illinois, about a month ago. And this is his story. From In These Times, another one of my favorite sources for good labor news.
Heck yeah.
And Mike Elk has this to say. He says, last week I caused a minor controversy when Huffington Post fired me as a blogger for helping a group of construction workers disrupt the Mortgage Bankers Association conference in Washington, D.C. He says he put fired in quotation marks because he, like the majority of people who blog for the site, was never compensated for his years of writing for the website, nor did he ever sign a contract for the privilege of doing so. But he says his actions raised legitimate questions about journalistic ethics, but perhaps we should also ask questions about the twin crises of the labor movement and labor journalism. Why are the struggles of workers so rarely covered by mainstream journalists? The celebrated polemic Rolling Stone writer Matt Taibbi wrote a whole book entitled Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and the Long Con That is Breaking America. After reading it, you would think that the collapse of the American economy occurred because Wall Street had robbed America of their assets during the internet and housing bubbles. What Taibbi fails to note is that Americans only went on a credit binge because their wages, on average, had been declining for decades. Coverage of workers' declining standards in most media typically paints workers as meek and incapable of doing things. Liberals often call on the government to do something to help workers, but miss the point that workers can act to change their situation by improving their own workplaces. Why is it that so many well-intentioned writers miss this important point? Perhaps because the corporate owners of publications have completely eliminated their labor journalists. But even nonprofit, so-called progressive publications like The Nation, American Prospect, and Mother Jones regularly cover gay rights, foreign policy, media policy, etc., but mostly overlook labor stories. Why? One reason is that many journalists have little or no familiarity with organized labor or labor struggles and are unfamiliar with what can be achieved through organizing and solidarity actions. Journalists tend not to see strikes and lockouts as national struggles about corporate power, since strikes in most industries typically occur only as part of a specific contract. Local strikes, however, tend to have bigger implications. If a company wins concessions from workers, other bosses in the industry may see it as an opportunity to go on the offensive. Journalists also tend to see stories about workers getting screwed over by evil corporations as cliched, lacking in news value. They also tend to view worker struggles, which are often unsuccessful, as boring compared with grandiose debates by elite think tank policy wonks. Journalists spend a lot of time writers for other elite opinion makers who offer top-down solutions. But by failing to cover labor struggles and presenting workers merely as victims, the vast majority of U.S. media outlets and their reporters and editors are doing the nation a great disservice. Workers will feel more inspired to organize in their workplace and communities when they see more positive stories about the labor movement appearing in publications they read regularly, or at least stories that show workers acting collectively to control and improve their lives. Such inspiration is needed on a grand scale in order to rebuild the labor movement. The U.S. economy will never be nursed back to health until we restore the power of the labor movement. Otherwise, workers will never receive a fair piece of the corporate profits they generate.
There was a point made there where they felt that at least in this generation of journalists, not many of them know people who would be union members, and that would tend to get worse and worse as the percentage of union members in the population goes down. And also, I mean, just in a more general class situation, the media is very low paying with entry level jobs, with, you know, many of the young people that you see out carrying those cameras around or standing in front of them with a microphone are actually interns who are paying tuition for the privilege, they think, of being involved with that TV station there. And then, you know, if they get hired, they're making very little. And what I'm saying here is it will become increasingly difficult for working class and lower income young Americans like that to have careers in the media, because their families would not be able to support them in those careers. And that is someplace where the labor movement, at least around here or in the smaller markets, has really fallen down, and that is not organizing the media. I mean, some of the newspapers are organized. That's kind of a legacy from back in the old days. But the broadcast media around here anyway are not organized at all. Right. And they pay extremely – I mean, I tried working at a TV station. If they paid any decent money, I probably wouldn't be here.
That's why we're all volunteers here.
Yeah, I wouldn't be working, you know, out of the laborers' hall if local TV stations paid a living wage at least.
Right. We're lucky we do have the Independent Media Center in Urbana, and that's another avenue. People should investigate that. They can use that facilities to help get their voices out on the air and in print and whatnot. So,
Jason? Yeah, and they do good work, especially on a wide range of issues and labor issues. And I think this connects with what Bill was saying earlier, that to pause on this for a couple of things. And Bill brings up a couple important points. One is on culture, and the other is especially this with media, that in so many places, even in unionized media outlets around the country, they're de-unionize through decertification pushes and also just through technologies that eliminate union jobs. I know in some places, especially in Western New York where I'm from, where there are fewer union members in good part because people who used to operate cameras and other things. These are basically people-less studios except for the people who are on the air.
Right.
So that in so many ways, where unions even do exist, are pushed out. And this other point, too, is important, especially that Bill brings up as far as this the issues of culture in relation to the story with that Bob brings up. This is huge because it's so easy to forget that where labor's friends are often really circumscribed, and at times the left needs to be taken to task for this, that Elk's story is a prime example. Huffington Post is a liberal-to-left blog, and yet he, for whatever reason, Elk is no longer writing there anymore, and this was unpaid work as it was anyway, but Elk is one of the primary and few labor journalists around the country.
Right.
And, I mean, look at in so many places. You have issues of labor derided, and I've mentioned this off there a few weeks ago. I'll never forget Eric Alterman during the transit strike in New York City a few years ago, who's on the left to liberal side, who talks about labor issues in a friendly sort of way, complaining about during the strike about being inconvenienced and how the students were inconvenienced when it came to getting to classes, and complaining about this instead of being on the side of transit workers who are facing wage cuts and workplace issues. And this disjuncture between the left and labor, and also between the left, who in some realms talks about workers in the abstract in a very friendly way, but then when it comes down to the meat and potatoes issues of supporting them, so often fail to do so. And so culturally, these middle-class people and institutions as gatekeepers and people who provide necessary information for people are the ones who so let working-class people down when it comes to the information that they need. They write them out of their own histories.
Yes. Tom, you got a new story there?
Yeah, one more.
Okay.
Illinois Governor Pat Quinn has signed legislation providing a $2,500 tax credit to employers hiring trainees from the Put Illinois to Work Temporary Jobs Program. The measure, which was signed on Monday, January 17th, was to take effect immediately. Governor Quinn says the new call provides employers with an incentive to continue providing jobs to those who need them. Employers who hire a former trainee from the Put Illinois to Work program are now eligible for the Illinois Small Business Job Creation Tax Credit of $2,500, which is presently available for small businesses. The new law requires that the employees receive no less than $10 an hour in wages, with a minimum of $18,200 annually. The bill was sponsored by Representative Corrine Gordon, a Democrat from Coal City, and Senator Jeffrey Schoenberg, a Democrat from Evanston.
All right. I think we're going to go to a story from Hightower News here. Looks like this is going to be Tuesday's. It's something dealing with the EPA revoking a permit for decapitating of West Virginia mountains. So we'll go to that, and then we'll come back with Tom's poem in the Cultural Corner.
At last, a small spark of sanity from Washington. After making a full scientific assessment of environmental impacts, the EPA has revoked the permit for the largest mountaintop removal project ever to assault the natural resources and the people of Appalachia. Unfortunately, this spark of sanity set off an explosion of babbling madness by the coal mining giants. Arch Coal, the holder of the permit, said it was shocked and dismayed that EPA would dare revoke it, shrieking that this was, quote, an onslaught by an overreaching agency that will have a chilling effect on future U.S. investments. Then came West Virginia's corporate-hugging senator, Joe Manchin III. It goes without saying, he began, before proceeding to say what did not need saying. Parroting Arch Cole's script, Joe called the revocation, quote, a shocking display of overreach that will have a chilling effect on investments. Joe was followed by a cabal of non-mining corporate interests which did a frantic Chicken Little imitation. Pulling this one permit, they screeched, will be staggering to the whole U.S. economy. Get a grip, people. This permit should never have been issued in the first place. It was carelessly handed out by the Bush regime, which was infested with industry operatives. Now, EPA has merely done the responsible environmental assessment that the Bushites refused to do. Talk about an onslaught that would be shocking, chilling, and staggering. Bush's permit would have let Archco decapitate all the mountains in a 2,300-acre stretch of Appalachia, shove the toxic rubble and waste into the valleys, bury the streams, kill the wildlife, and pollute the water supply of people downstream. This is Jim Hightower saying, mountaintop removal is a brutal, totally destructive abomination done solely to make quick profits for a handful of coal executives and rich absentee investors. It's about time they were told no.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Yeah, we love Jim Hightower here, though.
Oh, yes. He may be 100 years old, but he knows his stuff.
Yeah, he's a character. He's good. All right, we come to that part of the program, Tom's poem. And Tom's poem for this week is College Kids from Garcia's Loft.
Garcia's Pizzas used to be located on Wright Street, just south of Green on the Champaign side of the street. At street level was Garcia's restaurant, and upstairs the dining area known as Garcia's Loft. I spent a lot of time at Garcia's Loft in days gone by, sitting by a second floor window, looking out at the campus grounds, and writing. One of my personal favorites of the countless pages I wrote there is this poem entitled College Kids from Garcia's Loft. They hustle, bustle, to and fro, about the campus grounds they go, each with a life that is their own, some are together, some alone. Yes, it's as it has always been since first I grasped the poet's pen. I see a stranger's face below, looking like one I used to know, but that could not possibly be, they all are strangers now to me. Ones I once knew are all gone now, fate has taken them all somehow. Some marched away to fight in war and died on some far foreign shore. Some just moved on to other lands and some wear golden wedding bands. Perhaps that stranger's face I see, the child of some old friend may be. I watch the young ones passing by and wonder at the tears they'll cry. How many soon will soldiers be and march to die beyond the sea? How many of their hearts will break when love's rough road they choose to take? In all these years it hasn't changed, almost as if fate has arranged an endless circle to go on, until the days of time are gone. They'll hustle, bustle to and fro, until beneath the ground they go. College Kids from Garcia's Loft was written at Garcia's Loft in Champaign, Illinois in April of 1984, and has been recited live at various venues since, most recently being this January 29th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Thanks, Tom. Excellent.
Thank you.
Couple public service announcements here. I want to remind you, as usual, about Labor's View TV, Sunday, local cable channel 6 at 4 p.m., starring our own David Johnson and our friend Jim Iman. Tune in Sunday, local cable channel 6 at 4 p.m. Also, want to let you know that we are in the midst of our third annual radio food drive, and contributions can be made online at weft.org or sent to WEFT P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois 61824. For every $10 donated to WEFT, the station donates $1 to the food bank, and the food bank can then turn that $1 into $10 worth of food. And they serve an average of 44,000 clients each month within the 14-county region of eastern Illinois, and one of every three of these clients is a child. So you can help out two worthwhile organizations at once there, WEFT and the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Couple other short little public service announcements here. This month coming up is the 9th birthday for Workers Independent News. They started 9 years ago back in February. You can check their stuff out at laborradio.org. We frequently play some of their clips here when we got time and get around to it. Also want to let you know that most of our recent shows are uploaded every week to radioforall.net. You can go to the right-hand column. You can browse programs by series is how I do it, and you can click on the letter I because they're all under the Illinois World Labor Hour. And also, Jason's got the blog up there at illinoisworldlaborhour.wordpress.com, and you can check out Jason's Illinois World Labor Hour blog. And Bill's got a comment?
Well, there's even older stuff on Radio for All, which you might find browsing that way, that just is the Illinois Labor Hour without right. the world.
Right. We've had some gaps in our coverage of getting those shows up there.
And I don't know, there may be even some really old Peter Miller from East Illinois Labor Journal or whatever we originally called the show that I thought sounded too much like a newspaper.
There are some very old Peter Miller things up there. They're all under different names, you know, but...
Radio for All, there's all kinds of really cool things on there. And there's a show I really like called Unwelcome Guests. That's a two-hour show that some woman does, I think, back east. That's really interesting. Gets into a lot of really interesting economic-related issues and such. And
there's a lot of worthwhile information up there at radioforall.net.
Right. I like it.
Okay. Yeah, we do too. Jason, you got another news story relating to the NFL lockout, possibly?
Yeah, sort of. And before I get to that, as usual, a typically great poem, Tom, and also a nice piece of local history for those of us who are not from around here. Never knew that Garcia's actually had been at that point on campus.
Well, that was a couple of decades ago.
Garcia's used to be big, man. They had places in Normal and Grand.
Garcia's used to have several locations in, you know, like other towns, too. I don't know what happened. They're down to only two locations. I think Ralph's got one and Joe's got the other one. Like ones, they got one in Rantoul and the one out at Mattis. But
I think
that's
about
it. They used to be
big,
man.
Yeah, right there on Wright Street, right across from the alma mater statue there. You could sit up there in that loft like Tom was talking about, watch all the people walking around. It was great to go up there, grab a beer and a slice of pizza.
That's a great perch.
Yeah, oh, it was wonderful up there.
Interesting. Yeah, especially this about the NFL, and important to keep in mind, too, that the NBA might also face a lockout as well. That I know a lot of people, I'm sure, are sports fans. I know I am. And that these times, and especially with sports, things are not often framed in terms of class, and I think it's difficult to portray an awful lot of athletes, many of whom are millionaires, as an oppressed class. But I do think that there are class issues very much rife through these labor negotiations in sports, and I would say in sports in general, that are worth discussing here, and I'm interested to hear some people's thoughts too. But within a month of the Super Bowl, I think it's March 3rd, the NFL contract with the Players Association is due to expire, and that there seems to be an impending lockout, and even though there have been a bit of progress in negotiations, it seems quite likely that this is going to be the case, and for people who might throw out the line of it's millionaires negotiating with billionaires, I would say that there are an awful lot of people in the NFL who don't make nearly as much money as others, that, like in so many parts of our society and workforces, there are class issues among players as well, where many don't spend much time in the league, they don't make nearly as much money as others, and they're subjected to dangerous working conditions and injuries on a weekly basis. And also a couple things to keep in mind, too, that this is, and I would say this has been the case in labor negotiations and sports in general. Anyway, this is pretty much a naked power grab. The NFL has never been more awash in cash than it has been in the last several years, with billions of dollars of income coming in through not just ticket sales and merchandise, but especially through television revenue, which if there is no season next year, the NFL teams will still make billions of dollars in order to tide them over just from television revenue. So they can afford to sit and squeeze players. And this is really what they're looking to do, is looking to squeeze several hundred million dollars out of players. And we could talk about this, and I think in sports these things are complicated. That is, you know, whether or not people should have to pay an awful lot of money to go to games, whether or not working class people are squeezed out of something that's increasingly becoming the provenance of middle and upper class people and affording to even go to games. But a couple of things to keep in mind. Each and every NFL franchise is worth at least $1 billion, according to Forbes magazine. Wow. So these teams are not hurting when you think about this and you think about issues of class. And at the same time, too, the NFL is talking about going to an 18-game schedule. And this is all at the same time that we're learning a lot more, but not nearly enough still, about head injuries, concussions, and other things too. So exactly what we want to get out of players in order to entertain ourselves and to enjoy a game is something I think we ought to consider, especially if this does come to a lockout in just over a month.
I've said for many years, no more public money for these private entities to build these stadiums to keep these teams in these cities. These teams hold these cities at ransom and say, we're going to move, and they end up getting $500 million or $1 billion to build a stadium there, and that's utterly ridiculous that taxpayers should be funding that for these private entities that are making billions of dollars, as you say.
And I'm a big sports $50 fan. To get in and watch a game.
Oh, $100 nowadays. I mean, it's ridiculous. Even college sports, they charge an arm and a leg to get in there, you know. Bill?
Well, if you Google NFL average salary, here's a page here, it's called buzzle.com, and it says a collective bargaining agreement in 2008, the minimum salary was $295,000, and in 2009 it went up to $310,000. They don't have 2010 up there. But, you know, you're talking about people, I don't know how many years, and if you're getting the minimum, then you're probably not going to be kept around very long. Obviously, the team probably wouldn't care about you. The average salary in 2009 was around $770,000 a year. So, and the average base salary of an NFL, well, this doesn't really make, the average NFL player salary was around maybe I'm reading this wrong. It says here the average base salary of an NFL player in 2009 was around $990,000.
Right. And that would factor out things like incentives for performance, for things like that.
Making the playoffs or leading the league or being in the top 10 for something.
Yeah, often statistical base, and especially geared towards star players too.
Right, yeah. If you get 1,000 yards rushing or
3,000
yards passing.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing, too, is and there was a very good study done in baseball. I would say less a study, but more of a long article that was on a blog called Mike Asmore's Thunder Thoughts. He writes about Trenton Thunder, which is a Double-A team in the Yankees organization, and really talks about this enormous disparity between minor leaguers and major leaguers, but even among minor leaguers, of those who are signed to, especially younger players, to particular size contracts with the expectations that they may rise, and especially older players in the minors who make roughly the equivalent of fairly well-paid industrial or public sector workers, really, that they don't, and they're basically seasonal people, so their incomes are. Is actually something that a lot of people can associate with, where some of these star players make an awful lot of money, and that'll boost the average.
All right, how about if we go to this little audio clip I prepared here? This is, I'll say this is highly edited. This is some clips from Jimmy John Leotard when he was on comments he made when he was on Penny for Your Thoughts on WDWS about a week or so ago. And as I said, this is highly edited.
Highly controversial.
I cut out all the good things he had to say about how this was a great country and he loved this community and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm making him look bad here, but that's okay. We'll play it anyway, so I hope you enjoy it.
And I would say they're his own words.
They are his own words, his opinions, and he'll claim them, I think.
Well, first of all, I mean, this happened so quick. I mean, when I found out about that this was going down, my friend Dan Rutherford, who's the new treasurer, told me about it, and that was right at Christmas time. So I immediately went to Florida, rented a house, got my kids registered for school, and took care of that right away, because he said he thinks they're going to sneak this thing through just like they did this this health care deal. They were taught by the president how to sneak stuff through, and I said, geez, okay. Classroom in my office here that seats 70. We average 53 seats full in that classroom. That classroom is live 7 days a week. We don't get days off like, this left side of America does. We work 7 days a week. The classroom is, this is crushing to me. I mean, this is destroying me right now. This isn't, and it's just a matter of principle. I'm sorry, I'm going off. I don't think this is about the business. I think it's about the people that are in power that love the power. And they love the power so much, they're addicted to it, and they'll manipulate and do whatever they can do to keep the power. And they're not in it to build America, and they're not in it to get us debt-free and to get us efficient and make us a world competitor again. And they are dumbing us down, and they are stupefying us, dumbing us down so that they can stay in power and stay in those private planes, because they couldn't do it in the free enterprise way. And that's what they're doing, and that's my opinion. And I don't need to be right, but I believe that's what's going on, and it makes me absolutely. And my father saved enough money that he started his own business in 1967, molding plastic around metal. He was the pioneer of insert molding. And my father, what a wonderful man. And he did this all on his own. And my father, and I will tell you, that company was established in Elgin, Illinois. It's called Capsonic Group. And do you know when NAFTA happened and we were able to open a maquila in Mexico, in Juarez, Mexico, my father had 800 jobs in Elgin, moved the plant to Mexico because he could, for the same reason the last caller did, and my father has that plant today. Actually, my older brother runs it. And we couldn't have stayed open had we not moved the plant to Mexico. It was because of the increased regulations in Illinois. So this is not new to my family. This is. I'm sorry for being so. I'm passionate, and it hurts me. And I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry too.
A lot of people are sorry.
If I offended him, but those were his own words. I just edited out all the good parts and tried to make him look a little bad. So
I'm not sorry. I think it's
I'm still
poignant.
Trying to find the left side of America.
Well, you need a day off to do that.
Yeah, yeah. You can't be working 7 days a week if you're on the left side.
That's right. It's so stark, and there's nothing more poignant than providing a critique of someone by using their own words.
Oh, yeah, man. His dad was such a great guy.
Yeah.
You know what? Laid off 800 people in Elgin so he could exploit Mexicans.
Yeah, yeah.
His
quote in the News Gazette, I believe, was, "I'm not a greedy American pig." So just,
I guess just his dad. I don't know.
Guess. I'm not sure.
Yeah, why don't Jimmy move to Mexico, you know? So if everything's too much for him here, he probably have much lower taxes in Mexico. I don't know.
He's on his way. He's going to Florida.
He wouldn't be allowed to own any property there, but...
You know, we're so sneaky up here, you know, like nobody knew we were going to raise the taxes here or nothing, you know.
Yeah, it was like he had to emergency... rent a place in Florida and enroll his kids in school. And God, man.
Just like the president snuck that health care through. Nobody knew that was coming. We didn't talk about it for six months or nothing, you know.
Yeah, conflating the Illinois legislature with, it's just being realistic. I don't want to pay higher taxes.
Me neither.
I'm going to pay for it one way or another. It's going to be through property taxes, or it's going to be sales taxes or something. But that money's got to be there for something. And if you've been driving around lately, I think you can pretty well see where we shouldn't. We got things to do and things that need. I wish they'd get somebody with a weed eater out to knock the weeds down that are growing up through the cracks in the concrete. In a lot of places, most places around here anymore. I mean, it's just disgusting. You know, it looks like, you know, we're living in a third world country around here with the way things have gone completely to hell. And it's because, I mean, we should have had a progressive income tax taxing Mr. John or whatever his name is.
Leotard.
A fair amount more than 5%.
Up to 5% now.
Yeah, I mean, he should have been paying an Illinois state tax of like 70% or something.
At least.
You know, based on his... See, because they base that stuff on the 1040 anyway, on the federal one. And you know how people get all of those deductions on their federal tax?
Yes.
And then, so, you know, they're paying hardly any Illinois tax anyway, no matter what the tax rate is.
Like you say, Bill, back in the day when people were paying 70% income tax and stuff like that, they reinvested their money back into the business because they weren't all of those billions of dollars in their own pocket. They put it back into their business, hired more American workers and stuff like that. So,
and that was during a period in which this nation's economy roared. I mean, you're looking at
We always hear about the greatest generation after World War II and after Korean War. All these people came back and how the economy did so good and how those people just really built America to what it is, you know?
And you have conservative film directors like Roger Zemeckis making movies like Back to the Future, you know, looking back at those days. Of course, if you weren't a white male, you know, things weren't so good, and they weren't so good for a lot of white males back then. I mean, I can remember, even though it is getting, I'm showing my age there, but the thing is, I do think the country at that time was a lot more equal. I also, and like I was talking about earlier, I think we also had a much greater culture of the working person, a much greater respect for working people. And before the end of the hour, do you want to get to one thing? Speaking of working people, the working people of Egypt are rising up. And Damian Matthew, he wanted to hear a little discussion of this. Well, that's something that we used to kind of bring up, or I used to bring up anyway, for sort of a little bit of a joke, because News from Neptune is so focused on the Middle East, like I'd occasionally find some story about Palestinian unions or something.
Right.
Yeah, because there's more going on in the Middle East than Israelis and Palestinians being mad at each other, and there's more going on besides us just getting oil there. I mean, there's the people who are producing the oil and not getting very much for that. I mean, this isn't about, this has not been about Islamic fundamentalism. This isn't Al-Qaeda inspiring this, or in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood, or anything else. What's inspiring this is a generation that is just sick of not having employment. You know, I mean, a country that was, I mean, this is a part of the world. You know, we got to remember something, folks. I know there's a lot of you redneck people out there, and I heard this out of your very mouths over the last several years, that you just want to take nuclear weapons and make a glass parking lot out of this mm-hmm. place, and you're really upset because these people are living on top of your oil. But I mean, these were great civilizations. I mean, not just the ancient Egyptians and so on, but you had the Ottoman Empire. Most people don't remember. All they think about World War I is the Germans. No, World War I was a war with the Ottoman Empire. You know, and that's where a lot of this stuff goes back to, is the destruction of the Ottoman Empire and English, the British, drawing lines in the sand, basically, or just lines on maps. And that's why, you know, a lot of things have happened this way. And then there's the exploitation. These people, I don't know. It's just another one of those things where we've always felt like our politicians have always felt like they've had to support the very worst person. You know, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard, you know, right. The old quotation. And, and you had things like Mossadegh in Iran in the 1950s being overthrown by Kermit Roosevelt. Yeah. You know, not FDR's, but you say what?
Eisenhower?
No, Kermit Roosevelt was he was a nephew of not FDR, but the other
Teddy Roosevelt.
I'm sorry, yes, the Bull Moose guy. You know, and instead of trying to work, live up to our democratic reputation and all the bragging about democracy and everything, instead of trying to work with, people like Mossadegh when they came up, or say Castro in Cuba, or many, many other regimes. And God, if you just look back at those things, and instead of us having to have all this military and that, I don't know, maybe it's just so frustrating. There's so many points in history where things could have changed and they could have been done for the better, except for the ignorance and fear of many people and the greed.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
There's the three things Buddha talks about. You have to get rid of your ignorance and your fear and your greed.
Buddha was a wise man.
Yes. All his things were about living well together. There's really no moralistic thing to them. It's all practical.
How about if we go to a little musical break here?
Well,
one of our friends, Ann Feeney.
Oh, right. We like Ann. I think she's I haven't seen anything by her lately, but no. She was doing pretty well.
We need to check on her current health status.
Yeah, stay well, Ann.
listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us. Fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Say
war on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling. It's a war on child labor protection. It's a war on the 8-hour day. It's a war on occupational health and safety. It's a war on Social Security. Now, thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF, and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time. We started calling the shots.
And we're back. You are listening to WEFT Champaign, the Illinois World Labor Hour, and a few closing comments.
Someone had mentioned to Bill off-air and sent a message saying that, and bringing up the point that while acknowledging this about owner's greed, that Jimmy John's had, or that Jimmy John's, yeah, talk about a Freudian slip, Jerry Jones had ultimately decided to invest his own $1 billion in a new Cowboy Stadium in Arlington, Texas. He said at least mention that fact. And we did, Kendall.
Yes, he did.
And he did. And
the Yankees spent a lot up there in New York, too. But
yes, most of that was through the business's money, although they got about $300 million in tax-free city bonds that they'll end up paying back. And two, that this is true about owners, and some do invest in their own, or there's a hybrid system of funding between state and local and the business's own money at the same time. Where could this money be going if they are using public money? And two, are people, everyday people, actually able to afford to go to these games? That is, they're priced out of the events which are said to be for the public good.
Okay. Anything else?
I think I've filibustered enough.
All right. Stay tuned. K Kiwis here with Close to the Fire, and we'll get their song, their theme song going right now. Tune in next week to Illinois World Labor Hour. Thanks.